I'm beginning a session on a liturgy for the human community with the arrival of women on center stage. And we're welcoming people. If you haven't been welcomed before, I'm supposed to in this session, so I'll say welcome to you. I know a number of you, so it doesn't feel unfamiliar here. And I don't know how many of you were with me in the first session. Okay, I'll repeat some of the things I said there just to give some sort of a background for what I'm trying to do. I am working in the Continuing Education for Religious Ministry section of the Department of Conferences at the University of Minnesota, but I'm not speaking on their behalf by any means at all. I've come here as a Lutheran Christian, concerned with some things that have haunted me, I suppose you'd say, for many years. Early on, back in the 60s, became involved in liturgical renewal, and as we thought of it in those days, entering into things out of a folk perspective. And so since about 61 and 62, I've been involved in writing folk liturgies, folk songs, and through these years I've accumulated songs. And I don't really know quite when, but someplace it occurred to me that I had a lot of songs about the Bible, and in time I began the project 5, 6, 7 years ago of writing songs about the Old Testament. And by this time, I have about 50 or 60 songs that cover at least all of the books of the Old Testament and a lot of other kinds of incidents within the scriptures of the Old Testament. I also, in the latter years, have come into some rather difficult projects and work that I've done. And the thing that really shaped a lot of, particularly some of the songs that we'll be singing, came out of 3.5 years in the inner city, working with a radio station for low-income minority people that was just barely alive all the time, and setting itself in many ways against a lot of things that were going on. And in that struggle, to really fortify my inner life, I made up songs. This was my way of fortifying myself, of meditating on the scripture to keep alive, and I mean that literally. I survived that way, along with a good home that that gave me some nourishment. And that's how I got onto this project, and now I've got the songs, and I want to know what to do with them. And so I'm here at Holden. This is the first real playback of a lot of the songs. There are some songs that have been in the public arena, let's say, for a number of years. But the good share of them are being played and sung here for the first time or the second time at the very very most. I also am concerned with liturgies, and I'm not talking here about cultic liturgy, not the liturgy of Sunday morning or of the standard services as we know them, matins or vespers or some of the other offices, compline and the like. I'm interested in developing a way of getting at a liturgy for street life, a liturgy for the daily life. And these songs, which are folk, are intended in some way or another to give a reinforcement or a possibility for doing some of those liturgies. And we're going to try one today. And I talked last time, and I'm not going to get into it again, but from two sides, I felt people do not know the Old Testament. I think that people also are confused about the world that they're living in, and so these liturgies are intended to acquaint us with the Old Testament literature in a way, though, that's different from what you might get out of other contexts, and also an attempt to thread through some of the things that come in the way of problems in our present world. How does my story relate to the stories that are current, that are just happening all over the place? Earlier, the stories of black liberation, of Native American liberation, of Mexican American liberation and so forth, and then coming into the gay liberation, women's liberation, handicapped, plus the swarm of refugees that are upon us with their new religions that are new to us, I should say. How do you make sense out of all that? And that's only what I'm trying to do with some of the things that are here. And this time, today, I want to take an exploration of a theme that runs through a hidden liturgy about women, which I'd like to explore. And this is the first time, this board is the first time this has been any place with any group. And we'll see how that comes out. On Thursday, I want to explore if you take clusters of books or clusters and sections of the Old Testament and put them together. And I think there's a liturgy of urban descent, D-I-S-S-E-N-T, descent, that one can discover in the literature after the destruction of Jerusalem, which not only was the way they survived, but maybe it's the way we survive, and I'll explore that on Thursday. Today, I'm taking this theme, and we'll see how it all comes out. I have just been reading here in the library here another book by Letty Russell called Human Liberation in a Feminist Perspective, a Theology. And she talks about a usable past and that much of the Old Testament is difficult because it is a patriarchal book. How do you live with what is very evident almost on every page? And so I'm trying to discover a little portion of that usable past. It's presumptuous for me to come as a male and talk about feminine things. Nonetheless, I think it is of importance to the human community that we find a mutual kind of liturgy for the human community that will enable us to make it into the future. And so I'm making bold to put this forward, not as a final thing. Maybe we'll have to erase some of it, but to see how it comes out and whether it has possibility. I talk, frankly, much more in terms of liturgies than theologies. Sometime when I really feel like I'm up to it, I'm going to debate some theologians about whether theology is really a truly Christian enterprise and whether we aren't really liturgists and whether really living by faith is reciting liturgies is over against constructing large kinds of arrangements of how the world is, which is what the theologians talk about. Now, that's not fair to all of them because they're moving all the time with their theologies and so forth, and I don't want to put them down totally. But I took comfort from reading some years ago that one fellow thought that theologians were the grave diggers of Christianity. So I kind of enjoyed that. And these are then attempts to discover a liturgy that might enable us to move into the future in a very precarious, and I really mean that, a precarious area of church life and of the human community's life. Let me illustrate this by a song which I wrote some time ago. And it's a very simple song, and you can learn it almost as quick as you hear it. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, my ancestors, warts on their ears and their cheeks full of whiskers. God made a people of humble clay fashion, strong ones with faith, but their sins they need rationing. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, my ancestors. Sing that with me. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, my ancestors, warts on their ears and their cheeks full of whiskers. God made a people of humble clay fashioning, strong ones with faith, but their sins needed rationing. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, my ancestors. Now, I'm not going to sing the whole song for you today. It can be used in different ways, but let me sing that second verse for you, and you can join along if you want to. Abraham, he had a wife named Sarah.
God promised them that in time she would bear a son. Many years later, the laughter satirical, no son would come, it would take near a miracle. Isaac was born, he a child named Laughter. Now originally that was the song Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But someplace I began to say to myself, why not Sarah, Rebecca, and Rachel, my ancestors? Who knows their faces, or who knows their beauty? God made a people of humble clay. Well, that's the song. And then I got to thinking about, of course I'd pick out Sarah, Rebecca, and Rachel. How about Hagar, Rebecca, and Leah, my ancestors? Add to them names of the handmaids of Jacob. We, you know, it's a part of our patriarchal tradition that we center on one side of the ledger, and it was the way that they preserved their ancestry and so forth. Nonetheless, it is kind of ironical that there is that hidden side of the Older Testament that rarely comes to the surface. And my intention then this morning is to say, is there a way that this surfaces? And if so, what might we be able to do about it? Is there some possibility that way? And I'm sort of going to be moving along with, looking for one more thing here. Let's see. With an attempt to say, this is an outline for a liturgy that we might use that might help us maybe in household liturgies. I'm not quite sure where they're usable, or maybe just for our own interior life, a way of thinking about what's happening, hopefully a way that will open up not only a way to think about it, but give a lot of room for the sort of thing that's happening, because women are really on the move. They're writing, they're saying things that frankly give me really all kinds of anxieties and wonderings about what is the meaning of all this. So this is not a liturgy to confine, but a liturgy to open up, to help understand, a liturgy that may have whole territories that can be carved out with respect to one rubric of what's going here. So that's sort of what it is. If we can think about this in such a way that it's stoppable at any time. In other words, I don't want you to get into the notion it has to be gone through totally without any interruptions. It's to be thought through. And if you think the sequence makes any sense, it'll help me in making up my mind whether I ought to write it down and whether we ought to use it elsewhere. I'm not sure at this point. So, where do we go? First of all, I think I'd like to read a passage to you that is very interesting. Still looking for one more item here, and I don't know quite what I did with it. I must have left it up at my cabin. The book. Let me see.
You don't need it?
No, there's a... It's a... Is there something to turn out? Okay. Now, to me, there is a passage that Russell has that perhaps we can begin everything with. And it goes like this. In Romans 8, starting at the 18th verse, I consider that whatever we suffer now cannot be compared to all the splendor as yet not revealed, which is in store for us. The created universe is waiting on tiptoe for the children of God to show what they are. In fact, the fondest dream of the universe is to catch a glimpse of real, live children of God. As we all know, up to the present time, the creation in all its parts groans with pain like the pain of childbirth.
But not just creation alone groans. We ourselves, although we have tasted already the Spirit, we groan inwardly because we are still anticipating our adoption as children and the full liberation of our human existence. And one more passage by a woman named Raden Kartini, who lived in Indonesia. In 1899, she wrote that. And if you can imagine, Islam is, of course, the religion of Indonesia, and that what she's crying out about is still in process there and probably a long way behind where things are here. She says, in my thoughts and sympathies, I do not belong to the world of the Indies, but to that of my white sisters who are fighting for progress in the distant West. This in 1899. Century-old unbreakable traditions hold us today in a relentless grip. One day that grip will slacken and we shall be able to struggle against it, but it will not be for a very long time. It will come about, I'm sure, but perhaps not for another 3 or 4 generations. You cannot imagine what it is to love the new age with all one's heart and soul, yet to be bound hand and foot, chained to the laws and customs of our country. All our institutions are totally opposed to the progress for which I long in the interests of our people. It's a beautiful passage. And perhaps the invocation in a certain way. And then one more final thing, and then I won't be reading this much anymore, but a passage which Russell writes about Jesus. She says, perhaps it is no wonder that the women were first at the cradle and last at the cross. They had never known a man like this man. There has never been such another. A prophet and a teacher who never nagged at them, never flattered or coaxed or patronized. There is no act, no sermon, no parables in the whole gospel that borrows its pungency from female perversity. Nobody could possibly guess from the words and deeds of Jesus that there was anything, in quotes, funny about women's nature. Now, with that in the way of an invocation, let's talk in Older Testament terms about the passage of women to their right. And I'd like to start with a very obscure woman. In fact, I'm sure that those who make the business of studying the scriptures are living would know her, but basically not many others do. How many of you know Tamar? Very, very obscure person. And you'll see why in just a moment. There is a chapter in Genesis, chapter 38. And 38 is one of those rather lurid, vivid, earthy chapters that everybody feels embarrassed about when they read it, and which kind of is upsetting because you don't know what to make of it. And there it is. When you go to the commentaries and read about this chapter, you can just hear the commentators talking. They don't, it makes them very uneasy, and there's very little about this chapter. It's just kind of over as fast as a commentator can get through it. Because it's not been a story that the church wants to think about, or maybe others as well. Anyway, the story is briefly this. It was a rite in those days that when a child had not been born to the wife of a man who died, the brother would raise up seed to his brother who was dead by that woman. And that was a rite, stated rite in the customs and so forth of the time. Well, Judah, who is one of the great patriarchs, one of the great heads of the tribes of Israel, had two sons, and or three sons eventually. And the first son married this woman, Tamar, and he died. He was not a great and good man, according to Scripture. We don't know anything more about him than that. She was given to the second son, Onan, and Onan turns out even worse than his brother. He was an evil man and refused really to raise up seed and spilled his semen on the earth, and from that we get Onanism. So it's about the only thing for which the chapter is famous. And he is, it says, slain by the Lord. Was that bad about the fellow. And so no seed to this woman, Tamar. Now, Judah doesn't know quite what to make of Tamar. two of his sons have died marrying her, and we don't really know the whole story of why, but maybe there was really bad blood or relationships between the two of them, and what was supposed to be her right in the third son was not granted to her. And so she waited and waited, and nothing happened. And the time came when she should have been given in marriage to this third son. It didn't happen. And so that's where this story begins that I'm going to tell you in a song. And again, you can sing this with me a little bit. I realize that these are not always the most familiar melodies, but at least we can get some idea of how it goes. Really needs a voice like Joan Baez. The tune is traditional, and she has sung the original folk song. Well, Tamar was a woman strong, whose right to birth and heir was taken from her by her kin, but she did not despair. She sat beside a traveled road till someone did give heed. He stopped and gave her payment, and both fulfilled their need. To Tamar now a child would come. The family was upset, and Judah raged to punish her, and everyone did fret. But Tamar went serenely on, and little did she say, well, who's the father of this child? You'll know, she said, one day. The punishment's a burning, and so her time did come. Old Judah blamed her righteously, and tongues around did hum. She sent a thing or two she had to Judah, staring wild. She truly is more just than I. The right is to this child. If you get the outline of the story, that Judah, in the meantime, had lost his wife, and so he was feeling sexual hungers, and as he goes on a journey down the road, which evidently was a trip that everybody knew about, Tamar seats herself as a prostitute along the road. He goes into her without knowing who she is and gives her gifts for her services. And then she comes back pregnant by him. And that's where the song all kind of holds together. And Judah, of course, is righteously incensed about his daughter-in-law. He just was glad for the occasion to do this business to her, because finally he was going to settle accounts with her. And, of course, the whole thing turns around in a very striking way, and he is revealed as the person who is the father. It's a story, as I say, that's not taught in Sunday school and not usually read in homes, and yet there's really profound kinds of truth running in that story, which I think the church needs to reflect on and meditate about. And that's where the rubric, as we talk about this passage of women to their right, comes, the woman as outlaw. Now, I think we have to really think about that there come times when the law of the land is not sufficient, when in fact it can be a part of a tyranny of those that rule, and that when nothing else is left, people step outside that law in order to accomplish what is right. And so she outlaws herself as a prostitute in order to accomplish her right to reveal the truth about that situation. And I think it is something at least for our thinking about when we see the kinds of things that happen not only in women's liberation movements but in other liberation movements where very, very, let's say, odd and strange things to us are done. They are ways of people stepping outside what is the tradition and protesting by these very odd and strange kinds of circumstance. And women, in many ways, have been forced to that kind of thing. In fact, if you know the book called Working by Studs Terkel, there's a very interesting, it's a whole lot of people talking about their work, maybe 100 people. And he interviews them, and it's a fascinating book. If you can get it, you should read it, just all for all kinds of interesting information about people. And there's a prostitute who talks about her life, and she talks about the power that she has over the men who come to her. And it gave me kind of a new insight about why a person might be a prostitute. When there is a powerlessness, to get a power which is rightfully yours, you turn to an outlaw kind of situation. Now, I am not trying to condone or justify that kind of thing. I'm saying that those kind of patterns emerge when society's laws do not really minister to the situation that is obvious, maybe obvious to everybody. And it's very obvious in our society that the power, which should be balanced between the sexes, is swings very heavily on the side of the of men. Okay, now that's that rubric, and let's hear then something of a comment on this that one might get out of the New Testament that Jesus is involved in. So.
Okay, this is from John 8, verse 3 through 11. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman who had been caught committing adultery and made her stand before them all. "Teacher," they said to Jesus, "this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. In our law, Moses gave us a commandment that such a woman must be stoned to death. Now what do you say?" They said this to trap him, so they could accuse him. But Jesus bent over and wrote on the ground with his finger. As they stood there asking him questions, he straightened up and said to them, "Whichever one of you has committed no sin may throw the first stone at her." Then he bent over again and wrote on the ground. When they heard this, they all left, one by one, the older ones first. Jesus was left alone with the woman still standing there. He straightened up and said to her, "Where are they, woman? Is there no one left to condemn you?" "No one, sir," she answered. "Well then," Jesus said, "I do not condemn you either. Go, but do not sin again."
It's a related story, not precisely the same, but a related story. And I'm a speculator, always have been a speculator. And it's good up here at Holden, mining country, I guess, to be a speculator. What do you suppose he wrote on the ground in the sand? I've just been doing some thinking about it in the light of the things that we're talking about here that have been happening in our society. I saw the King of Kings years ago, and he wrote thief, and he wrote murderer, but I'm not sure that in the light of our own time that we'd need to, it's down below there. There it is. We need to think about those things. Maybe he wrote in the sands, "Where is the man? Why don't you stone him?" I don't know, but I think there is some kind of possibility that that this might be the direction of some of the things that he wrote on the ground, and one by one they go away, or something that he said was very, very strong in another part of Scripture: "Whoever looks at a woman to lust after her," which means not to desire her but to make her into a thing, commits adultery. I don't know what he might have said, but the relationship of man and woman is very central to that event, and the very imbalanced way they chose to deal with it is over against what happened to the man is quite obvious in this passage. Okay, anyway, there's something here that seems to me needs our reflection, gives us some room to think about if we run across news accounts, kinds of things that astonish us, as they did in the 60s when some other people were at liberation things and did all kinds of, in quotes, peculiar things. That's a rubric. And that's what I mean, if there is a way that can refresh us and be helpful to us. Now, I don't know whether if you're not understanding what I'm saying, let me know. And yes?
I didn't read the article last night. I just happened to glance in the newspapers over in the other area that said, they showed a picture of a woman. It's an organized crime, equal opportunity employer. And I thought, that's true. We can be really good at that.
Yes, see, the moment you step outside the law, anything goes, and that sometimes there's honor among thieves, as they say. So maybe. I can't really say about that. Okay, any other comments? That's very good, and that's what I'm speaking about.
Well, I was just thinking while you were describing that, that Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter is much, much later, but it's exactly the same old routine, right?
Yeah. So it's been going on for centuries, perhaps as long as most of the civilization that we know in the West, at least, has been going.
And well, it still is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So this is, in a sense, a way of opening or creating a stance for Christians for thinking about what's happening and giving some, at least, gentleness and mercy in how we interpret. And to me, that's more essential than understanding everything or figuring it all out, and especially coming out of the male side of things. I obviously, and I'm speaking, I think, for men in general, not completely able to acquaint myself with all the things that are happening in the feminine world. And I'm not going to be able to keep up. As an older guy, I've run out of the energies to read voluminously, and so I have to sort of set myself in some way or another, so that I can operate with some kind of flexibility about the world that I'm encountering, and maybe this would work. Okay, let's try a second way station or second rubric. This is another woman of the Old Testament, Deborah. Deborah was a judge. You might know her better. I imagine most everybody is familiar with her story a little bit. And this is kind of, an English folk song style. I'm not quite sure. It's like a lot of other folk songs that you've heard. Mm-hmm. It goes like this. And this I have trouble playing, so if I foul up one. Canaanites were mighty men with chariots of iron, bound the people 20 years, and who would sound the siren? Deborah, no man had the spine. Deborah, oh, you look so fine. Deborah, wake woman, oh, you look so fine. Oh, try it so that you can.
It's not focused very well. It's hard to read the words. Maybe there's a way of clarifying.
Does anybody know precisely how to do?
There's a button.
Does that help?
That's better.
Okay.
It goes. I think it focuses by going up.
By going up and down. Okay.
Canaanites were mighty men with chariots of iron. Found the people 20 years, and who would sound the siren? Deborah, no man had the spine. Deborah, oh, you look so fine. Deborah, wake woman, oh, you look so fine. Oh, people could not walk the roads, but crept along the byways. Dead the villages of Israel, who would free the highways? Deborah, no man had the spine. Deborah, oh, you look so fine. Deborah, wake woman, oh, you look so fine. Oh, Sisera, a conquered tyrant, flees o'er hill and dale, careful of another woman by the name of Jael. Deborah, no man had the spine. Deborah, you
look so fine. Deborah, wake, woman, oh, you look so fine, oh. Our story was just very simply that one after another, different kinds of people oppressed the children of Israel after they got into the promised land. And they lived in bondage to the Canaanites. And there were other judges in other eras that rose up, like Gideon for the Midianites and so forth, but nobody was prepared to do that in this era of their history. And so Deborah, who was already evidently thought of as a very wise, prophetic kind of person, was called to do this task. There was a fellow named Barak that probably should have done it, but he didn't have the courage. He had to have Deborah as kind of a central figure to finally defeat Sisera, who was the head of the Canaanites, and who had chariots of iron. The children of Israel didn't have iron, and that's where all these peoples within the promised land over and over again oppressed them, because they hadn't learned the trick of making things out of iron yet, and weren't allowed to have any smiths either. There was no smith in the land, it says someplace, in those days. When Sisera fled away from the battle, he found refuge with another woman by the name of Jael. And she was an Israelite, and she drove a stake through his head, and he was killed. So that's why you have to be careful, Sisera, of what's going to happen. And it's another woman that comes into the picture. Now, that's sort of speaking about how women do what needs to be done in a, quote, a man's world. And let's hear a passage out of the New Testament that is related in a different way to the same thing.
The resurrection from Mark 16. After the Sabbath day was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices to go and anoint the body of Jesus. Very early on Sunday morning, at sunrise, they went to the grave. On the way, they said to one another, "Who will roll away for us the stone from the entrance to the grave?" It was a very large stone. Then they looked up and saw that the stone had already been rolled back. So they entered the grave, where they saw a young man sitting at the right wearing a white robe, and they were filled with alarm. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "I know you are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was nailed to the cross. He is not here. He has been raised. Look, here is the place where they placed him. Now go and give this message to his disciples, including Peter. He is going to Galilee ahead of you. There you will see him, just as he told you." So they went out and ran from the grave, because fear and terror were upon them. They said nothing to anyone, because they were afraid. After Jesus rose from death, early on Sunday, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, from whom he had driven out seven demons. She went and told it to his companions. They were mourning and crying, and when they heard her say that Jesus was alive, and that she had seen him, they did not believe her.
Okay. That's enough said about that, I guess. Doesn't need to be elaborated on in any way, particularly. But if any of you want to make comment, you're welcome. Okay, let's move on to the next. This is again another portion of the Older Testament. This song you can sing without any trouble. It's a cherry tree carol melody. And you'll recognize how to sing it as soon as you hear it, I think. When Naomi was an old one, an old one was she. She came back to her homeland, and her sorrow all could see. She came back to her homeland, and her sorrow all could see. Okay, sing it with me. When Naomi was an old one, an old one was she. She came back to her homeland, and her sorrow all could see. She came back to her homeland, and her sorrow all could see. Her husband dead, her two had left but widowed brides, and a not a child for caring, but Ruth was at her side, and a not a child for caring, but Ruth was at her side. And Ruth was now a stranger, a come from foreign lands, and not a penny having, save the working of her hands. And not a penny having, save the working of her hands. And when the two were hungry, full hungry were they, Ruth went working in the fields. Boaz saw her that day. Ruth went working in the fields. Boaz saw her that day. And then the two were married. A happy time was this. And Naomi sang a new song, and all was wedded bliss. And Naomi sang a new song, and all was wedded bliss. They had a little baby of David's ancestry, and Ruth was in the family of the king from Galilee. And Ruth was in the family of the king from Galilee. Oh, you who mock at poor folk, or seek a race that's pure, oh, give reverence to the stranger, for the Ruths they will endure. Oh, give reverence to the stranger, for the Ruths they will endure.
Well, that's just saying a situation that was true in that time. They had to go into the fields and glean to live. It was a welfare kind of way of living. And it is also true that those who bear the brunt of the welfare system of our present society are women, again, and that there are many kinds of things said about them. I lived in a community of them, worked with them for about 3.5 years, and I know how put down they were and are in our society, and how many ways we have of sneering at them. On top of being poor, they are also somehow or other blamed, as they say, blaming the victims. Now, someplace the Bible speaks to that out of this story. It says there was concern, but it's very fascinating that when Ruth worked in the fields, it says that Boaz saw her and was rather taken by her, and he said to the people who were doing the reaping, watch out for her. Don't let her get caught out too far away where men can get to her. So evidently, not only were you gleaning to get enough to live, but it was a dangerous kind of thing for your own sexual life. If you read it, that's really there too. There are other parts of the story that we could reflect on, but I don't want to take all the time there. But there's room there, I think, to think about the condition of women, that they bear the brunt, that when there is a divorce, for instance, that the male goes off, under most circumstances it seems, and makes his own way on with a life for which he's prepared. And many women who have given their life as wives to the situation are absolutely unable at the moment to really take care of a family, and yet they're in that kind of circumstance. This is a little bit of a reaching. Maybe you might think of a better passage, but there is a story of something that is at least analogous.
A man named Lazarus, who lived in Bethany, became sick. Bethany was the town where Mary and her sister Martha lived.
This Mary was the one who poured the perfume on the Lord's feet and wiped him with her hair. It was her brother Lazarus who was sick. The sister sent Jesus a message. Lord, your dear friend is sick. When Jesus heard it, he said, the final result of this sickness will not be the death of Lazarus. This has happened to bring glory to God and will be the means by which the Son of God will receive glory. Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus.
Okay, I'm just touching on something which showed something of the compassion of Jesus before the whole chapter was out for two women who we probably wouldn't think too much about in the story, but were really verging on the same kind of situation that had happened to Ruth and Naomi. They were going to be women in a society that didn't really know what to do with them economically very well. And we'll just kind of leave it there. Let's move on to another of the Old Testament people. The last of those that we'll be using. This is, a woman that's more familiar than Tamar was. And this is a song that is to be sung. The Book of Esther is always read in Jewish life at the Feast of Purim. It celebrates celebrates their deliverance from the Persians, who had made this law that they should all be killed as a result that is reported in the Book of Esther. And so this song attempts to move at that some. And I think at least you can get the tune or the melody as you move along. It's familiar again as a tune. It's don't know really where it comes from. Dancers at the dawn of time, all singing like a lark. Do not fear the ghosts that walk, though they look grim and stark. Soon the forms will go away, let them come another day. We will dance and dance away the dark. Try that. Dancers at the dawn of time, all singing like a lark. Do not fear the ghosts that walk, though they look grim and stark. Soon the forms will go away, let them come another day. We will dance and dance away the dark. Esther was a noble queen so far beyond her lord. Some were waiting, they were lean and sharpening the sword. Pogroms come with mad decree, they will pass and we'll be free. We will strike the strings and play the chords. Dancers at the dawn of time, all singing like a lark. Do not fear the ghosts that walk, though they look grim and stark. Soon the forms will go away, let them come another day. We will dance and dance away the dark. Think on old man Mordecai, with knees that wouldn't bend. Sooner spit and sooner die than grovel at the end. Haman build the gallows sound, watch the rope go round and round. Gallop poles don't always call the trend. Dancers at the dawn of time, all singing like a lark. Do not fear the ghosts that walk, though they look grim and stark. Soon the forms will go away, let them come another day. We will dance and dance away the dark. Ahaz, where is King of Kings, who had a wooden head? Thought he's right in everything that ever he had said. Making wooden-headed laws just as bad as any Shah. Filling all beaches, holy, unholy dread. Dancers at the dawn of time, all singing like a lark. Do not fear the ghosts that walk, though they look grim and stark. Soon the forms will go away, let them come another day. We will dance and dance away the dark. Esther, keep the name of God so deep within the heart. Never say a word of it, but keep your thoughts apart. Time for faith to show its face. Be a savior of your race. Take your risks and know just when to start. Dancers at the dawn of time, all singing like a lark. Do not fear the ghosts that walk, though they look grim and stark.
Soon the forms will go away. Let them come another day. We will dance, dance away the dawn.
So, in some sense, I don't know what to call this rubric, Woman as a Savior, or another way of saying it might be a woman functioning in the Older Testament as a type of Christ. There are some ways of looking at a lot of the Old Testament figures as being types of Christ. Let's hear the responding passage here.
Then Jesus went to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And on the Sabbath day he went as usual to the synagogue. He stood up to read the scriptures and was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it is written. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He has anointed me to preach the good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free the oppressed, to announce the year when the Lord will save his people. Jesus rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. All the people in the synagogue had their eyes fixed on him. He began speaking to them. This passage of scripture has come true today, as you heard it being read.
And now our liturgy takes a turn. And we go back, back in a way to the beginning of time and to the creation. And this is one line missing. I hadn't written it when I was doing this, and I forgot that I didn't put that line in. So this is a look at wisdom. There's a very striking passage, and maybe. Mr. Picard, would you read that passage first, and then we can understand a bit more of the psalm.
The Lord created me in the beginning of his work.
This is about wisdom, and wisdom is portrayed here as feminine.
The first of his acts of old. Ages ago I was set up, at the first, before the beginning of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs abounding with water. Before the mountains had been shaped. Before the hills I was brought forth, before he had made the earth with its fields, or the first of the dust of the world. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he made firm the skies above, when he established the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limit so that the waters might not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him like a master workman. And I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world, and delighting in the sons of men.
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The knowledge of God aright understanding. My child, as you grow, be acquainted with wisdom. For wisdom has come from the dawn of creation. Wisdom remembers God's oldest work. From the everlasting world she comes. When the earth's foundation was laid, she was there, the delight of God on high. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The knowledge of God aright understand.
Well, time is really running out of me, and I could go and sing a song that I sang last night on Genesis and creation, and linking another kind of interesting thing, that the spirit that is mentioned moving on the face of the deep is feminine in its gender. And there, most people, you know, say, well, don't take that too seriously. But to me, maybe we have to think about that a little bit and ask ourselves what that might be. Now, kind of moving along very rapidly, there's an interesting quote in this book by Letty Russell. What if there were a revolution and everybody won? And to me, that's a neat saying, and it's a helpful saying. It's saying that there has to be, in the midst of all the revolutions that we're talking about in this time, some sense that that everybody can win. And I think that there is, in what's happening in much of what I see as a man within the situation, a good and affirmative kind of thing in every way, healthy for the women, no doubt, but also for men, so that we can be reduced to being human beings. And that's the most releasing, freeing word that I can think of, that I'm free to be human, not to be God, not to be an animal, but to be just exactly human. And to me, that's my calling, to be a human being. So this revolution, in its very strongest sense, I think is saying to us, let's return to a situation in which everybody functions as human. And then, if you move into that kind of situation, I think you're ready for singing a song that has to do with one of the most beautiful of all of the Older Testament books, the Song of Songs. And I'm not sure about this, but I decided a while back that I would use this particular melody. And you know the melody. And it's very rare that I've moved into sacred folk song, although Cherry Tree Carol I did. Let's try this. I'm not sure yet that I like the interpretation that I've given. So this is a song that, if you have some feelings about it, or maybe it isn't exactly the way I ought to say what the Song of Songs is about. It's got a lot to say as far as that goes. Sing me a song, O my husband, my king. Richer than wine is the loving you bring. Love, you are radiant. My kiss be a sign. I, my beloved, is mine. You know the tune. Sing it with me, and we'll sing it all the way through. The two verses are to give balance, and the third is to say then a final way in which our love is sealed. Sing me a song, my husband, my king. Richer than wine is the loving you bring. Love, you are radiant, my kiss be a sign. I, my beloved is mine. Sing me a song, O my bride, O my queen. Like a locked garden, all flowered and green. Wake and oh, north wind and south, do not cease to blow on my garden and let me find peace. Set me a seal on your heart, write my name. Fierce, yea, a fire is my passion that flame. Love strong as death, and the lost world around. Waters can wash away the love that we find. There's a very marvelous book by Dorothy Tribble. We were
Phyllis
Tribble. I can't get the name straight. I've got it up in my cabin. I think it's called God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality, in which she explores many of the Old Testament passages and does them remarkably and very helpfully. And what she does is says that the Song of Songs has to be read into the third chapter of Genesis as a, you might say, talking about something in terms of health as over against what is a chapter that talks about the imbalances in society between men and women. The Song of Songs, she says, is a song sung about equals. I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine. It's both and. There is not any difference between the two. In some places, it seems to me, that's where we need to arrive.